everyone, and welcome to Home of House Plants, the podcast. A tangent today, we are speaking to Andy Baker, known on social media as Planty Andy, and we have a wonderful story to listen to today about how Andy developed a passion for aroids and his recent trip to South America, where he will tantalize us with a wonderful story about his travels through cloud forests in the mountain regions of South America. And I'm sure you will really enjoy this episode. Andy, welcome.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Andy, tell us a little bit about yourself. A lot of us will know your social media handle, Planty Andy, on a lot of the aroid pages on social media. But yeah, who are you, Andy? And tell us, how did you get into aroids?
Oh, I'm just another one of those sort of Gen Y, mid-20-year-old persons who just got into plants recently with the big boom of it all. I spent a few years of my life in Tassie, where I'm originally from, moved up to Brisbane about 8 years ago to study to be a physio. Once that graduated, moved from the Gold Coast up to Brisbane, and I've been up here for a few years now. But what sort of really, I think, set me off is I think it's one of those things where a lot of young people find that gardening is in their sort of family history. So, for example, since I was a little kid, I can always remember heading off to the nurseries with my mother. It was a really fun activity. I really enjoyed it.
You enjoyed it as a youngster? Yeah.
I think it was mainly the opportunity to sort of run between all the plants and sort of climb all through all the pots and everything. So it was like a bit of a playground for me, I think it might have been.
That's a common story that you hear about, isn't it? Just developing that passion at a young age. And some don't enjoy it. Some go begrudgingly, but you clearly fell into the other category. You loved it.
Yeah. So Mum used to also do a thing where she'd have a couple of plants that she wants. She'd go, I'll pick one out, and I'd pick one out. And I was quite an active kid. I still play a lot of sport now, and I played a heap when I was younger.
Yep.
So I had balls and cricket bats and things flying around the backyard and myself sort of running around and whatnot. Mum was always like, be careful of the garden, don't tread on this, don't trample that. So she sort of worked up this little, she had this little theory where what she'd do is she'd get me to pick the plant out, dig the hole, pull it out of the pot, loosen the soil, put it in the hole, and then compact the soil around the outside. It's sort of like a thing where I've actually planted it myself, so therefore I might actually look after it and not run over the top of it, as she quote her.
And did that strategy work? It did?
I think it must have done. Obviously, there was a few things that I may have accidentally broken, but I'd say it's probably been a sort of bit of impact on sort of the plant person I am now at the moment.
Oh, how fabulous. So, from a young age and through your teens, but this is, in Tasmania where, the tropical doesn't come to mind. Aroid is not the category of plants that comes to mind when you're talking about Tasmania. How did you make the jump, if I can call it a jump? Was it the move to Queensland that got you interested in it? Or, how did you get to aroids?
So I think it was when I finished studying and ended up working. So when I moved to Brisbane, I was in like a rental, and I was like, I need to make this place look nice. And from when I was a kid, I always really, for some reason, appreciated the look of those yucca palms.
Yep.
So I bought a couple of them and just put on our back deck area. And I was like, oh, this looks nice. And I was like, I wonder what they look like if I put one inside. So then ended up with a Monstera, put that inside and started putting a few plants in there progressively over like a 2 year period.
Yep.
And then it hit about May last year, one of my housemates bought me, just for like a birthday present, was one of those the leaf supply books that have all the types of indoor plants, the sort of how to care for them, the water requirements, humidity requirements. So I was flicking through that book and I found this plant on there called a watermelon peperomia, and I was like, oh wow, that looks awesome.
Yep.
So guess what my next purchase was?
The watermelon pep.
Yep, I do. That's exactly right. So
now that
I was like, oh, a pepper.
Sorry, I don't want to interject you there. I'm just thinking about the time frame when you've discovered that watermelon peperomia would have been, as you said, about 2 years ago. That was at the height of its popularity, was it not? And so it would have been a little bit difficult to find.
So it was, I think it was about 18 months ago.
Right.
In Brisbane, we're really lucky. So we have a retail nursery called Oxley Nursery, which I'm sure you've probably heard about.
They actually grow
quite a lot of these sort of rare plants, do certain releases on them as well. So I just sort of stuck by their Facebook page and waited till something popped up and jumped in and got my hands on it first thing in the morning when they opened.
Fantastic. Wow. And so, you know, slowly, no doubt, weekend spot spent pottering at nurseries, markets, just adding to your collection and, you know, any opportunity you could. And it sort of, you know, increased in terms of density in the house. But Andy, I saw in some photos or the video that you sent me in preparation for this interview that looks like you've moved beyond the interiors of your home to some kind of shade house structure. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's been a little bit of a project for the last sort of 8 months.
Yep.
So it got to the point when I was like, so when I started to get into aroids, I remember I had a, so what it was that really got me into the aroids were that I was obviously collecting peperomias, and I was like, oh, I wonder if there's a podcast on peperomias. So I was just Googling peperomias podcast, and this podcast that we're on right now, Joe, your podcast, actually popped up.
Oh, wow, there you go.
So it was in January last year. So there was only one episode out at the time, and I was like, what's this? So I had a listen, and it was with a gentleman by the name of Neil Crafter, and they were talking about this P word called philodendron. And I was like, what's philodendron? I wonder if I have one of those. So I went home and looked through all, I think I had about, it was only about 30 odd indoor plants, and I managed to find one philodendron, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. It was a Moniatum, the fat boy philodendron.
Very nice. Yes. They're not easy to find either, by the way. They're a lovely sculptural plant. If anyone has a chance to have a look on Google Images, very structural and upright. But so you had one and you got a bit of a bug to find out more?
Well, a couple of days later, what actually happened was at Oxley Nursery, they were running, it was over Easter last year, they ran a little competition where if you spent X amount of dollars and mentioned this certain word, you were going to draw to win one of three plants.
Yep.
And I just so happened to win one of those three plants, which was, if you might guess, it might have been a what type?
A philodendron. Yeah.
So that P word pops up again a week later, and I was like, oh, what's this? So I ended up getting one that was labelled a philodendron varicosum.
Oh, my goodness.
But when I Googled it, though, Joe, it was just looking different, and I was like, I wonder what's going on here, and did a bit of research and found out that it's actually a hybrid. So it was Philodendron majestic, so the varicosum cross soda eye.
Oh, stunning plant.
And yeah, and then I worked out, I was like, hang on, if this is a hybrid, there's these two other plants that look awesome. I wonder how I can get my hands on them. And then that's sort of when the ball really started to get going and turn into a bit of an avalanche.
Yeah, and to accommodate this avalanche of plants, there's the shade house that's being built.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. Because once I realised that these plants are tropical plants and needed a lot of humidity to grow and to grow fast, I was like, all right. So then I actually hand-stitched a small, tiny little greenhouse. I got one of the old Aldi ones and adapted it to fit my growing collection. And by the time I'd finished that, I needed to build it up to a bigger one. And then that's when you get the big giant shade house that I've got in the backyard now.
Wow. So you did start off smallish, but when you say the big giant one, and did you hand stitch the big giant one in your backyard, or did you invest in sort of a pre-built one?
So it's actually, I didn't hand stitch that one. I hand stitched the smaller, tinier one. I'll send you a picture of that later on. It's quite funny. It's got like hand stitch zips on it into plastic. I don't know how it survived 12 months, but it's still going.
Yeah. But you get the big one.
So my current big one is actually just made out of star pickets, electrical conduit, cable ties, and bamboo.
And you built that one yourself too?
Yeah, so I had a few help from a few mates around here that have got a couple of like retail greenhouses, and I just sort of said, oh, how do I go about it? And I was like, they were like, just do it like this and it will just follow the shape, put some shade cloth on it and another piece of solar weave, so the white plastic stuff on the outside. And
yes.
away you go.
So being in Brisbane, because we have a lot of, believe it or not, international listeners, and primarily I have more listeners from the US than anywhere else. So for the US listeners, where Andy lives is a subtropical, tropical part of Australia.
Yeah, subtropical.
You know, heading towards a similar climate, I want to say, to Hawaii, basically paradise for aroids. The epicentre of aroids in Australia is pretty much the state in which Andy lives in, well, the coastal regions of the state of Queensland. Why I'm not living there, I ask myself every day, but I'll get there, Andy. I'm in a different part of Australia, but... So you wouldn't have the issues of frost that us southern state people have to deal with. So you're able to get away with a shade house for 12 months of the year, aren't you?
As opposed to a glass house. I've got it.
Yep.
Correct. So I've got it so it can be sealed off at the bottom so I can fully encase it in so that when it does get to the colder months, those fussier anthuriums like Warraquianums, they'll actually be able to survive in there and I won't have to move them around and bring them inside because I really want to keep them in those humid environments so that the leaves try and stay as blemish-free as possible and also can get to a nice big size too over winter.
Have you had – now, what I will do is I'll do a Facebook post when I publish this episode and with your permission, Andy, publish a lot of the maybe even the video that you did for me of your shade house so people can get an idea of the collection. But it's pretty comprehensive for someone that only started, getting close to 18 months ago. You've acquired quite a collection in a relatively short period of time. How have you done it? Where have you sourced from? And is it over a range of platforms? Tell us more. Where did you get all these amazing plants from?
So sort of most of my plants have been acquired. They started where everyone else sort of starts at a local nursery and then going from there and doing a bit of Google search, you end up on the rare plants page on Facebook, the Aroid Buy Swap Sell site, found out about the ASA, Australian Aroid Society, ended up there, made some contacts up there, but probably the best way that I managed to get some access to some harder to find plants and make some really good friendships with people is when I actually went up in July last year to North Queensland for work.
Right. And so, yeah, and what a fabulous, you know, hobby that's, I think I feel the same way and I'm going to speak on your behalf here, Andy. It's just opened up a whole new world of friendships, this plant hobby of ours, in particular aroid collecting. I have met so many wonderful people through the membership of the Australian Aroid Society. They have regular meetings and guest speakers and Christmas lunches. And it's a whole new world that I didn't know existed a couple of years ago, let alone, 10 years ago. It's changed my life. And it sounds like it's had a big impact on yours as well.
For example, like where I live in Brisbane, about 3 minutes away down the road, there's a lady, another ASA member I met there who lives there, and her collection is three times the size of mine, and the variety and the size of her plants are absolutely breathtaking. It's just one of those things, you just drive past the house every day and you wouldn't notice until you walked in the backyard and your jaw hits the ground and nearly cracks in half by the amount of sheer aroids that you see in front of your face.
And I want to just point out something here. You quite rightly, just in a passing comment you made to me while we're organising this interview, I think you are the first typical millennial category in terms of your age that I've interviewed for the podcast, and you certainly won't be the last. But I want to know, I'm a little bit older than you. I'm 40. You're in your mid-20s, mid to late now, Andy. what do your mates think of this? And do you know, are your friends interested in indoor plants, well, aroids or indoor plants as much as you are? Gardening was seen for a while there, certainly in the 90s and the early 2000s, as a bit of a daggy thing to do, something that perhaps older people might be interested in. Not that you can speak on the entire population of people in your age bracket, but what's the vibe in your friendship group about your hobby and what your friends think of it?
Well, sort of a lot of our mates have come, they know I've sort of been into this sort of thing for the last sort of couple of years, but when it really ramped up 12 months ago and they'd been away for a couple of months or a few weeks before they'd come to my house and there's all of a sudden the plant collection and the numbers in there is like tripled in size. They walk in and they're like, whoa, am I in a jungle here or am I at your place?
Yep. So they love it.
Most of them are like, Yeah, everyone does. And like, it's quite funny because my housemates have really sort of taken it in their stride, because I head away a lot for work, and obviously we'll talk about later on when I went away to South and Central America, like someone had to look after my plants. So a lot of my housemates and my friends sort of upped the ante and sort of babysat some of my plants and also helped to just keep my collection alive. I think I only lost two plants, and they weren't really ones that I was super worried about through my whole trip. So it's a big, like, sort of, everyone's embraced it. And now that a lot of my mates know sort of the, like, I'm not an expert, I'm not a horticulturalist, I'm not a botanist, but I've got a fairly good idea of how to grow certain types of plants. And so a lot of them, my mates, have come to me and said, hey, I want to put this plant here, could you have any suggestions? And I've given them a couple of ideas and say, go and talk to your local nursery as well, because they're probably the best ones to talk to. Don't go to the big green shed.
Yes.
Go to the people who are actually qualified.
Yeah, it certainly has taken off. It's nice to say, you know, generation. There's a lot of markets and festivals that you know, we don't need to mention names of, where plants are sold en masse, indoor plants are sold en masse. But I'm certainly, everywhere you go, renovations of restaurants and clubs and bars, new hotels. I stayed at the W Hotel for a couple of nights when I was in Brisbane earlier this year, and every room or public space in that hotel was dripping with green walls or hanging baskets from the ceiling that were dripping with devil's ivy. And it was something that's been embraced culturally, I think, and I hope, unlike the 70s where indoor plants were huge and they seem to have just faded away through the 80s and 90s, I do think and hope that greenery, real greenery in indoor spaces are here to stay. It has a wonderful effect on well-being. It's intangible, but I certainly feel it. It makes a room feel alive. I don't know what you think about that, Andy, but...
Yeah, absolutely, Joe. Definitely agree with that. And, like, sometimes some of my houseplants... my housemates would joke to me and they'd say, look at all these plants, there's so many plants in here. And I tell them, I say, look, I will remove all 30 of these plants out of our lounge room and put them outside, and you tell me what you think of this room then versus what it was like before. And as soon as I get halfway through that sentence, they go, no, don't worry about it, it's fine.
Yeah, goodness. So,
Like everyone really embraces it, and as it's a bit of a bug that people have sort of got to. And like, I think I started out just as a hobbyist, and now I've sort of taken the next step and gone full on plant collector. And I've got a feeling that some of these plants that I've gotten now will be plants that I will actually have when I'm older.
Yep.
So I think it's going to be a thing that's going to be here to stay.
You are going to obviously need yourself some kind of property in the future if you do move that can accommodate. That'll be a top of your wish list, Andy. Some people might be wanting en suites and things like that, or, you know, three bathrooms. But for Andy, room for the plants and the shade house.
Exactly.
Yeah.
give me a few nice trees with some solid bark and away I'll go.
Oh, God, stuff of dreams. Right, so just getting back to how you expanded your collection, a lot of, as you said, sourcing online, particularly it is in Australia at least, Andy, you will agree with this, it seems to be online, primarily through the Facebook groups, maybe eBay, but that's if you've got a lot of cash to splash. But then just through the social Facebook groups and social media, finding the collectors who will allow you to come on the road trip and pop in and buy cuttings from them is how to do it, really, isn't it? And fortunately,
exactly.
Yeah.
It's, as everything is in life, Joe, it's one of those things, it's who you know, not what you know at the end of the day. So if you've got a really good social network with people and, like, you're sharing things, sharing advice, sharing plants, just it works out to be in everyone's favour at the end of the day. And these are not stagnant things. They grow, they get bigger. So you can have a plant, you can cut it in half 6 months later, give it to another person, 6 months again, not take another cutting, give it to another person, and all of a sudden your plant is actually in three other people's collections.
Yeah.
In that time, they might have also cut it. It might be somewhere else. Like, there's I can't even really pronounce it, but a Philodendron warzawitzii is one of my favourite plants, and I actually got that from one of my friends, Bella Cameron. She used to run the Botanicals by Bella.
Yes.
And she does the workshops by Bella.
Yes.
So I got a plant off her that actually came from Steve Flood, who's one of the big collectors here in southeast Queensland. So when I went to Steve's place a few months ago, I was looking at his warzawitzii and I said to him, hey, Steve, guess what? He goes, what? And I said, I've actually got a piece of this plant that I got from someone else who who got it from you. So that's a sort of a bit of a insight into how these things can actually get shared around and do this big whole circle, and it just expands out. Like, that plant could one day end up in South Australia with you. Yep. It could end up in Perth. It could end in the NT. It could end up probably in my neighbour's backyard. It could. It's the opportunity and the possibilities for these to just grow and be shared around is just phenomenal.
Have you, as you're well aware, in the philodendron category, are you a I haven't asked you this, and I should have perhaps asked you this earlier. Are you a philodendron purist? Are you just looking to expand? But you mentioned anthurium, I'm going to pronounce it now as well, wracnonium. I can't even pronounce it properly. As I said, I need my coffee. You're not strictly limited to philodendrons. You're looking for texture and unusual foliage and something of a collector's plant. Would that be fair, Andy? Or what's your sort of requirements for collecting?
So I started with philodendrons, and I amassed quite a fair amount of those at once. And because I see myself as a collector, I like to have lots of different types of things. I've always been a bit of a collector and a hoarder. Yep. So when I was young, I used to collect a whole heap of, like, AFL cards and just a whole heap of things like that. So it's sort of been ingrained into me from what I've learnt through other experiences. But now I've sort of jumped into anthuriums, and I've ended up with a few species of anthuriums. However, the plants that I think are the coolest, Joe, are the ones that are the real complex hybrids that you can't even put a name on. They're the real stunning, those complex black velvet, the Hoffmannii cross, the Papillon cross this. Yeah, those types of plants are the ones that now I'm trying to fill my collection with because they're so unusual.
Yeah, Hoffmannii are just stunning. I'm too scared. For me, unfortunately, I can't jump in the car and drive up the road. Well, I could. It'd take me 3 days to get to where you are. But, you know, you've got the benefit of being able to sort of drive and properly put it on the front seat next to you with a seatbelt around it and bring it back home again. But Hoffmannii have to be posted, all of those kind of amazing plants posted to me. And then, yeah, they're always a little bit behind the eight ball when you go down that route. But absolutely. So it's really just you seem to be chasing the foliage, texture and appearance, really, isn't it? And that's where those plants fall into.
Absolutely.
It's never for us.
So my sort of...
Sorry.
No. So what I like, Joe, is I like the foliage because foliage is forever, where flowers can be only temporary.
Exactly,
I would like something that I can look at every single day of the year as opposed to only a certain few weeks, months and maybe even days.
Totally. I have to admit, I am, again, little side note, but I just discovered 2 years ago jewel orchids, and I'm not a huge orchid lover because I very much like you, I need the foliage to be there constantly as opposed to the fleeting moments of blooms. As lovely as they are, I fall into your category. But jewel orchids tick that box. They're just all about the foliage, and the flower is very insignificant. But unfortunately, when you went to a couple of orchid shows that I could access here in the southern part of Australia, in South Australia and Victoria, they're not present in the orchid clubs because orchid growers, and if I can summarise, do chase the blooms, don't they?
They do, absolutely.
And when you mention jewel orchids, or, you know, a few of the older growers might know of them, but they're never really there in the orchid clubs, or not on the radar of any of the orchid clubs shows that I've attended. I have been going to try to find them. But, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It seems to be a demarcation point almost between orchid lovers and the rest of us who do chase the foliage. So interesting.
Absolutely.
So tell me about your most recent trip, and it wasn't a quick trip, Andy, to South America. Why did you go?
No.
And what did you see?
Well, I went for about 8.5 weeks. So I left in the start of January and got back about 4 weeks ago, just before all the coronavirus stuff kicked off, which I'm very, very lucky for. But it's one of those things. A couple of years ago, one of my best mates said to me, she goes, "Oh, I'm looking to go to South America. Would you like to come?" And I was like, I don't know anyone who's been to South America. So I did a bit of searching, and obviously the Peru with Machu Picchu is one thing, and everyone's heard about Colombia, Costa Rica for its wildlife as well, and Panama again for its wildlife, and as everyone knows it, by the canal. But It's just one of those, like, a lot of my mates have been to Europe, and I was like, I'd like to do something different. And I'm a big outdoors person. I like to get outside.
Yep.
Where I'm more inclined to go and sit in a pub and have a few beers, but I'm quite happy to go out and just explore and just get lost inside all the nature, like what I did for the 8 weeks.
Yeah. So you decide to go. Did you end up going with your mate?
No, she pulled out. She ended up doing a ski season in Japan.
Oh, there you go.
And I was like, this is what I did. I was like, I told everyone I was going. So I was like, I have to go.
You have to go.
I'm committed.
So you're committed. The food would be amazing, by the way. I can only imagine the food that you try. To have a soft spot for that kind of food. But anyway, that's another podcast, another show. But you head across in January. Plant hunting would have been top of the agenda, amongst other things to see over there while you're sightseeing. But you did a bit of research and recon first to help you narrow down where to go. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, again, lucky enough to make some awesome contacts through the ASA. So there's a gentleman by the name of Bruce Dunson. So he's actually been over to South America and Central America a lot the last sort of 15 years.
Yep.
And what it was that spurred me, that wanted me to go there, was one of the plants I bought off him was an Anthurium wenlingeri. And on the wenlingeri, on the tag, he actually wrote the location where it came from. So I saw that and was like, ooh, I'm going near there. I wonder if I can try and find the original mother plant he brought the seed back from, or if I can find another similar one in a similar location that I know would actually have some genetic link to my plant back at home.
Yep. So you are inspired by a couple of fellow collectors here, and Wow, off you go. So you head over there. You make your way to, now you started off in Panama first. I'm just trying to think, what was it, Costa?
Yep.
Yeah, so that.
Peru.
Peru, I'm sorry.
Yep.
You go to Peru. So tell us just if we can summarize the key features through those, you know, countries. What did you see first, and what was the highlight of Peru in terms of the plants you found and photographed? And we will share those photos too.
So unfortunately, I didn't get any time to go to the Amazon, which is where some of the nice things would have been. But because I was I did a few tours, because obviously I travel by myself and Spanish isn't really my up there with languages that I know fluently. Sure. To get me around.
Sure.
So we just went to some of the main places. But where I found the most interesting aroids was in the most oddest location. It was actually I can't pronounce the name of it, but it's known as Machu Picchu town. So it's the town at the base of Machu Picchu, at the base of the mountain, where everyone travels to catch the buses up to the top. There was a big, like a rapid flowing river through there, and there was a lot of jungle. And just one afternoon, I just said to my tour guide, I said, hey, can I just go for a bit of a walk through just along the side of the road and just have a look? And Some of the plants I saw there were amazing. There was I sent you a picture of, there's an Anthurium there, an Anthurium species where the leaf that came out was like bright red. It was like really rippled as well. It was just a huge plant too. I haven't been able to get an ID on it, but fantastic. And there's a few other things I found there. Like, I'm not an orchid person, but I saw one of the prettiest orchids I've ever seen in my life. It was, as you mentioned just before, some of these flowering orchids that have the plain foliage. I nearly walked past it until I looked, because it was tiny and it had this like creamy coloured leaf with these yellow dots that sort of reminded me of like a cheetah.
Now, I think that's one of the photos you sent through to me, isn't it? I'm looking at it now, and again, we will share this on a Facebook post and the show notes. Wow. And this almost sounds like it's, as you said, side of the road, almost car park type plants at the base of the mountain to get up there. I wonder what was it interesting in terms of, you know, your tour guide. What did they make of it? You would have, you know, most people would be there for the cultural sights and sounds, which you were there for as well. But what did your fellow travellers make of it? Were you able to share your interest with them?
Yeah, so once they found out that plants are my thing, and I had a little bit of knowledge on it, and I'd like find something, and they go, oh, what's that? So there was a couple of people from Brisbane who were on that tour with me. And I would see something and then go, oh, this is that. And they go, okay, is it in Australia? And I said, yeah. And I said, you want to know the funny thing? You're like, what? It's a guess the price of like a plant this size in Australia. And they're like, I don't know, 30 bucks. And I was like, no, it's about 600. And their jaw hits the ground.
Yes, I know. I do like regaling my non-plant friends with those kind of stories. It's a bit of a, yeah, it's a nice dinner party story, isn't it, for people who don't live in our world, in terms of knowing the market rate of the hobby that we have. Wow. So, yeah, spectacular orchids. I'm looking down. I'm seeing that you saw was it a caladium next to a bird's nest anthurium?
Yeah.
That's another photo. But that's Colombia. Have we finished with Peru? Anything else? So was that the highlight?
Yeah, I also went to a place in Peru in Lima, so Lima's capital city. It's called Legends Park.
Yes.
So it's a zoo mixed with the botanical gardens and mixed with Incan ruins. And that had Lima's Aracia Club had a little section off where they grew a few of their aroids there, which so I saw a Monstera constellation in a non-tissue culture one.
Wow.
Because of the colour of the variegation. It was full grown. It was bigger than the Monstera deliciosa next to it. It was massive, Joe.
Wow.
I reckon it was probably a metre circumference. Like if I was to get a ruler and stick across from one side to the other, it wouldn't have touched each end.
Wow. Wow. And the height?
It wasn't really climbing. It was more sort of scrambling along.
Right.
But it would, as you notice, some of the philodendrons, all the heavier ones will go up and they'd like thanatophyllins and they sort of fall down again.
Of course
it was doing
they do.
Something similar to that because there wasn't a structure around it to grab hold of.
Right. Okay. Wow. Yeah, I would have picked my jaw up off the ground for that one. Wow. Goodness me. Okay. So... you get your fix, and again, unfortunately, photos was all we can do. Again, for listeners who are in the US, we do have strict quarantine regulations and legislation in Australia which prohibits anybody bringing any type of plant or animal material in, for good reason, to protect our natural fauna and flora. So lots of photos, and I've had the pleasure of seeing some of those from Andy. But, yeah, very, very hard not to be envious of the plants that they have over there in Peru. I'm scrolling down now, Andy, to some of the Colombian plants, as I just foreshadowed, the caladium growing in the stump. That was cool. I'm seeing a heliconia photo, some kind of...
Yep.
Ginger crabs. I think we call them here, the common name, crab's claw, but florists like to use them as well.
Yeah, crab claw ones, yep.
That was just on the side of the road, was it? Of course it would be in Colombia.
That was on the side of the road. But one of the interesting, what I did in Colombia actually, so I was on another tour there and I wasn't able to get to the jungle again. But what I did do is I when I was in the Bogota and Medellin, which are two of the three big cities in Colombia, I actually went to their botanical gardens and had a look there.
Yes.
Which was really interesting. So Bogota has an altitude of about 2,600 metres. And just to put that into perspective, in Australia, our highest mountain, Mount Kosciuszko, is only in the early 2,000 metre range.
Right.
So this is already taller than the city itself is already higher than any other city in Australia.
Yes.
So, and because it was located nearly smack bang along where the equator is, the temperature basically remains between 17 degrees and 21 degrees throughout the whole time. So there wasn't really many anthuriums or any velvet anthuriums they had growing there. However, they had this mass collection of roses, some absolutely stunning roses. So there was reds, pinks, yellows, whites, creams. It was unreal because of the constant, like, lower temperature. They were able to absolutely thrive.
Of course they would.
And even there was another plant I saw there, a philodendron. So the ID of it is a philodendron strictum, and it kind of looks like a gloriosum crossed with a rugosum, but without that texture. It has one sort of lighter white central vein, and it's almost perfectly round.
I think I'm looking at that photo right now. What a spectacular plant. My goodness. And with that kind of climate, they wouldn't get the fungal diseases that the tropical ones might do. So everything is exquisitely grown. My goodness. I'm just
scrolling. One of the other things there in Bogota too, Joe, was there was another anthurium, an anthurium pedatum, which was probably about 25, 30 years old. And the size of the stump was probably the size of about, or I reckon it was nearly the size of about a a small AFL ball, like a kid-size one.
Wow.
And it had a big, giant inflorescence on it, which was just bright red.
Oh, I can think I can see a photo of that as well.
It was huge.
And ripe.
So the thickness of...
Yeah, ripe with seeds as well. Yeah.
Berries falling off it everywhere, and I could see some of the birds would come along and pick at them and grab them, eat them and fly away again to obviously spread the seed around everywhere else. But to get into, like, you see that picture, it looks amazing, but people don't really understand how big that inflorescence is in comparison to some of the ones you see in Australia as well. So the thickness of that inflorescence was about the same thickness of what it is when you make a fist. It was absolutely huge. And I sort of tried to like lift it a bit and it weighed probably about 3-4 kilos.
You raise a very good point, is that the same genus and species grown perhaps in your conditions in Brisbane, Australia, versus me having an attempt at growing it here in a glasshouse in Adelaide in South Australia versus somewhere like Colombia. The natural variations because of climatic conditions are massive, and it almost, you know, it's that of itself is something to bear in mind and how impressive it could be, because it's just phenomenal. That description you've given of that inflorescence and the photo that I'm looking at now just makes you appreciate how wonderful nature is. And I guess it's, you know, the living conditions. It just has found its element in Colombia, and that's really where it thrives, versus perhaps here in Australia where we get a touch of that in certain areas like where you are, but nowhere to the extreme of that small, you know, city that you visited the plants at. So spectacular. Tillandsias
absolutely
as well.
Do.
I'm seeing photos of Tillandsias, so growing just in the nooks of tree branches. Is that a fair description, as you probably...
Yep.
Wow, so no doubt perhaps spread by birds or the wind, and they just set root.
Yeah.
And
if you look at the photo there, there's a photo there of the Spanish moss.
Yes.
And it is covering a whole tree and it hangs down. It looks like almost one of those like pictures in a photography like competition, like the setting of it. I walk past it and the jaw hit the ground again. And then I sort of made all of my fellow travellers aware to it, because they walked straight past it and they turned back and gone. And just went, wow, like...
It looks magical. It looks something like out of
a
Disney movie.
It looks like it's from a fairyland.
Yeah, fairyland.
Yeah. It's
Mother Nature, and just how beautifully the Spanish moss that this tree is draped in. Honestly, it does look like something out of a fairyland or a Disneyland world. It's spectacular. I can understand why you had to pick your jaw up off the ground again for that one. I'm scrolling down through the photo collection. I'm seeing alocasias. I'm seeing again a huge amount of heliconias, but I've stopped the scroll, Andy, and I think I am still in the how do you pronounce it? Bogota Botanical Garden.
Bogota, yeah.
I'm looking at. I want to say an Anthurium crystallinum, just in the garden beds there.
Oh, we're into Medellin now. So Medellin is about 1,600 metres, 1,600 to 1,200 metres.
Right.
So it's a bit lower, so it's a bit warmer.
Okay.
And it's a bit more humid. So they're actually able to grow velvets there. But these velvets are not native to that area.
Right.
Most velvets around are actually native to Ecuador. That's one place I didn't get to go to, which is definitely on my next list in 2 years' time when I head back again.
Wow, okay, of course they are. So that's interesting, and I need to educate myself more about, and that's something on the to-do list, Andy, of just where these plants are from so I can, you know, acquire that knowledge. But I'm looking at you standing next to a varicosum. The leaf is the size of – it's beyond a dinner plate. It looks like a small carry-on suitcase size. It's probably even bigger than that. Growing, you know. Just up a tree, up many trees, as I think you said to me, and it was somewhat like a weed. Is that true? You were seeing it everywhere?
Yeah, so when we talk about Panama in a minute, there was an area I went to in Panama where it was, you could probably not step more than 2 steps without nearly treading on the petiole leaf or even the stem of one. It was unreal.
My goodness. So that's, No, I've interrupted you there.
But
sorry.
That particular plant, no worries. That particular plant in that photo there, so this is in Costa Rica now, so we're a bit further north in Central America.
Yep.
So we actually got out to take a picture out of our tour bus to take a picture. And everyone went and took a picture of all the surroundings. And I looked across to the road and I saw one there and ran across the road and nearly got run over by a car. Just because I had to double take myself. I was like, is that a varicosum? Because you could see the pubescence on the petiole. And I sprinted over there and saw it and it was just amazing. So one of the things that I found about the varicosums is because obviously we know that they like cooler climates and they like cloud forests. So this particular area is actually a cloud forest, which normally would be covered in cloud during the day. So we ended up getting there on a clear day. So I was able to see like that and a few other interesting anthuriums and philodendrons as well that we drove past that I could sight out of the side of the bus. It was really awesome.
I am just imagining you'd almost not want your fellow travellers to be talking to you because my head would be plastered hard up against the glass looking out the door and it'd be hard not to shout out, stop the bus, every time you spotted something amazing. Wow.
The thing is though, Joe, like you... Once you see it once, you know it's going to be somewhere else.
Yep.
So they consistently pop up. So after a while, you sort of get, I know this sounds horrible, and there's probably listeners at home that are probably thinking, how could you do that? But I actually got desensitized to seeing the varicosums because I'd actually seen so many of them. It was like, oh, there's a varicosum, that's cool. I want to find something else.
Of course. Okay, right. So it was almost like a mental bucket list. Tick that box.
Yeah, absolutely.
On to the next one. La Fortuna.
La Fortuna, yeah.
La Fortuna is where you saw that varicosum that I spoke of. Is that right? I'm looking at the photo.
There's another one I saw there. There'd be a second photo of a bigger, darker one.
Okay.
So that one was there. So La Fortuna is at the base of the Ariana volcano. Another person who I talked to when I went places was Chris Hall and Arden Dearden.
Yeah.
Obviously, most people know Equatorial Exotics and All Floromaniac on eBay.
Based in Cairns, yes.
Yes. So I just messaged them and said, look, I know you guys have collected years ago. Where about some of the areas to go to? And Chris said, definitely go to La Fortuna. We actually collected a whole heap of really unusual anthuriums and philodendrons and other different types of palms and cycads from that area as well, and that was another cool place that I found. I forgot to send you the photo of this, Joe, but I'll send it to you later on. It's a very poor quality picture, but I found this triangular shaped like deltoid anthurium.
Wow.
And I was just I saw it and I took the picture, but as I took the picture I turned my shoulder around and found the big giant varicosum and then sort of moved the camera and made the picture quite blurry because I wanted to run over and have a look at it.
So you're in Disneyland, you didn't know which way to turn. There's just stunning aroids everywhere. What a problem to have. We forgive you for that blurry picture because I think I would be the same. My goodness. Oh, wow. And I should just say Arden and Chris, in terms of their advice, they were able to collect these specimens at a time and place that was very different in terms of quarantine laws. And so before all of that changed, I think they did a bulk of their collecting in the I'm going to take some liberties here, 70s or 80s when biosecurity legislation was very different. And you were able to, can you imagine, Andy, you were able to bring specimens back home from these exotic places. And I have had the pleasure of visiting their collection. It's housed in a spectacularly large shade house structure. I got quite emotional actually as a side note just seeing their collection, Andy. It's spectacular and a bit of a Noah's Ark in terms of what they are able to bring back with them and preserve.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Andy.
I still remember the first time. No worries. I still remember the first time when I went up there to see Chris Narden's collection. It was sort of at a time when I'd started to get right into aroids. That was the middle of last year. So I knew a few things, but I didn't know much. And I went there and my jaw just hit. And again, I come back to this term and reference a lot because it's true. It hit the ground when I saw some of the plants in there. There's an anthurium in there, which is right on my list of like my weird and unusual. It's called Anthurium verticans.
Right.
Verticans. So it's like it's a trilobe anthurium and the mature leaf is absolutely spectacular.
And I think just rivals anything that any botanic garden in Australia would have. I think it surpasses anything that any botanical garden would have in Australia at least. It's one of the leading private collections in Australia. of aroids.
Absolutely, 100%. And like people, a lot of people don't actually realise this. That's their nursery site. They've actually got a grow site in Wineville near the Arboretum as well.
Yes.
Where they actually grow a lot of their big stock plants and your big giant philodendrons and anthuriums that they take their cuttings from about this time. So around Easter, Chris mentioned that they do it.
Yes.
So
that's
another area that's a hidden treasure cove, yeah.
And it needs to be kept, kept under wraps because of, the demand of aroids and, what can go on in terms of people's needs and black market desires to get rare plants. So well protected, no doubt, and as it should be. But Andy, going back to South America, so I'm seeing now I pronounce it different back ears. I'm sure you do the same, different back ear leaves. Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. Scrolling down again. So, yeah. Tell me, now where are we here when I'm seeing those photos and some more honeycomb gingers, I think, as well.
So the honeycomb ginger and the different back ears, actually, we've moved up to Panama now. So we're into Panama. So in Panama, I had 5 days where I hired a car and basically drove it around to different national parks and just went and did certain trails just to look for some of these plants. So Bruce had mentioned to me that the Wenlingerai was found in an area called El Valle in Panama. So I basically based myself around there and tried to find that exact Wenlingerai, which was near a chicken farm where he imported the seeds off years ago. So that's what I was hunting to find. But I missed out. I never found that exact one. However, the trail that you're seeing the pictures from now is called Sierra Gatel.
Yep.
That is where I found the Wenlingerai.
Wow. And so you just basically had free rein because you had your own car. You weren't sort of obstructed is the wrong word. When you're on a tour group, you can't sort of indulge your little... when you find something you want to walk down that path, you can't do that. But now you reach total freedom and just could go, nerd out on plants in that region and walk the trails and found some treasures. Fantastic. It was, and this was pretty much solo. Did you have anyone joining you at this point?
No. So in Panama, it was all just me by myself. So I did. So through Peru, Colombia and Costa Rica, they were all organised tour groups.
Yep.
So I wanted to have a few days where I had no structure and I could actually have my own holiday before I came back home, if you understand what I mean by that.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's what Panama was. Panama was my own holiday where I got to do whatever I felt like, got out of bed whenever I want, ate whenever I wanted, and then went to sleep whenever I wanted as well.
And the weather looks like it was really kind to you. Did you go across in terms of it being the right time of year? And forgive my ignorance, I should know this, but in those kind of regions, is it like perhaps the Northern Territory in the northern part of Australia where you basically have the hot, muggy season and then the wet season? Is it similar in terms of their climates where they have two seasons as opposed to four? And you obviously went at the right time.
Yeah, so that's usually what you find whenever sort of any country is based, or landmass is based around the equator, and that tropical, the Capricorn and I can't remember what the Northern Hemisphere one is called.
Yeah.
But anywhere in that zone has that sort of two seasons, the rainy season, the wet season, the dry season. But it's, so through Central America, it's really interesting because obviously they've got a lot of mountain range through there. So you've got a Pacific side and you've got the Caribbean side, and each side has its own, so the Caribbean side has its wet seasons first before the Pacific side, and the Pacific side follows on as the Caribbean transitions over into its dry season. So you'll look at some, like if you looked online and researched when to go to these Central American countries, they might say don't go in this month. However, that's a broad thing for that whole region where that month might be perfect, say, on the Caribbean side. However, on the Pacific side, it might be the wet season. Yeah, there's a lot of tips and tricks that a lot of travel agents and online bloggers and people don't really sort of understand.
Until you've actually been there like yourself. That's fascinating. I wouldn't have thought of that little tweak. Okay, then. Well, this is going to lead me on to my next question or series of questions. If, people are listening to this who go, right, I want to plan ahead for a similar trip to these regions because I'm a diehard aroid fanatic. Were you happy with the countries that you chose to get a good exposure to these spectacular plants? Is there anything you would change? What can you just tell us as a cheat sheet to going on a aroid hunting holiday, let's call it that, to South America? What, first of all, choice of countries, were you happy with it, or, you know, would you have chosen a different, like Ecuador? Would you have added that to the list? Tell me, first of all, your choice of countries.
I think more just given the time duration I was there, I think four countries is perfect.
Okay.
The only thing I would have liked to have done would have been to go to the Amazon and have a look at some of the Amazonian species.
Okay.
And as you mentioned, Ecuador would have been a nice one to go to as well. But I think the best thing to do is to actually talk to someone who's been there multiple times. Example, why I kept sort of almost pestering Chris Arden and Bruce saying, hey, what about this place? What about that place? Like, where else can you recommend? Like, what areas and what tips? So when I was in Colombia, Bruce sent me a geographical map with all the height distances on there.
Yep.
And he said, you need to stay between this sort of elevation, otherwise it will be too cold or it will be too low.
Oh,
but mind you, though, I actually, when I was in Costa Rica, I was in a place called Manuel Antonio National Park. So it's like right on the beach, and it actually has what's voted the best and most beautiful beach in Central America. And about 100 metres inland of that beach was what I stumbled across, a shingling plant by the name of Monstera dubia, which was actually just gone right up the top of this ginormous tree, probably about 20 metres up the top. And between 5 to 8 metres up is when the leaves went from the immature shingling species to the actual mature leaf where it hangs out off the top of the plant. That was absolutely spectacular to see, because that's something you would not see in Australia.
No. Oh, amazing. Okay. So that's a very good point, of course. So you're saying maybe climate change has impacted on that as well. Who knows? Okay, so that's a fair point. You would try and do Ecuador, but there's a lifetime for return trips, isn't there, Andy? So that's on the next return trip to South America. I asked you this before we started recording. You felt safe in travelling in those countries? And
Colombia is one of the safest places I've actually been to, and Medellin is probably the best city I've ever been to outside of Australia.
Right.
I had no problems whatsoever. A majority of people in all those countries know a little bit of English. You should know a little bit of Spanish when you go there.
Okay.
It really helps. It really, really helps. And like countries like Costa Rica and Panama, because of the influence of the US over like the last few decades, their actual English is quite good there, and some people have a fair amount of English, and it's quite easy to get around.
Okay. So and because of that, that just made it a lot easier. And you had a sat nav to drive around as well, like when you did have your own vehicle.
So what I did is I got a three mobile SIM, as in three in the UK,
right?
Because it gave me a heap of data. I used that everywhere.
Okay.
So I used it all through Peru, all through Colombia, just as personal use, so that I could like use maps, because I've been overseas to some other non-English speaking countries like Japan, just even on personal holiday.
Yep.
And I noticed that you need Google Maps to get around. Like, you can't always rely on free Wi-Fi, because sometimes it's not there, especially if you need to get somewhere.
Of course.
So that's another really, really handy thing and a tip that I would recommend people to do as well. Like, so the maps worked well, but there were some areas where roads weren't actually on there, or if they were on there, they were incorrect. So then again, it helps to talk to your, just have a good discussion with your hostel managers and the staff who are working in the hotels where you might be staying, and just say, hey, I'm thinking of going to this area. How do I get there? This is the way that Google Maps is showing. Do you have any other tips and tricks, or could I go back inland or back along the Pan American Highway to get there? Is there an easier and safer way for me to get there? And they're more than happy to help out.
Oh, fabulous. So, and then you just mentioned you stayed in youth hostels throughout your trip. and that gave you that sense of community and the mixture of local staff who work there who have that local knowledge. But I'm sure, you know, whatever option you chose, Airbnb or if you went the hotel route, would be the same. But I love that point, just really pick their brains. And my gosh, you know, all it takes, a conversation like that then leads to, hey, you should visit my auntie, she has a farm up there, you know, things like that where she grows these cool plants.
Exactly.
It never ceases to amaze me, the little, you know, choose your own adventure routes that can pop up when you simply stop and talk to people and just have a chat about what you're doing and why you're there.
And they understand as well, Joe, you're a tourist, you're there to holiday, you want to have the best time. You want to come, like, you, they want you to go back to Australia and they want you to say how awesome that place is so that more people go there, because tourism is something that really drives their economy in those Central American, South American countries as well. So they're more than happy to tell you the little secret things, the best places to go to, keep you, put you off the beaten track a little bit to really, really get something out of your trip and really enjoy it and spread all the good news back with everyone in Australia and overseas and elsewhere.
Fabulous. Did you, I'm just trying to think, apart from that, aglaonemas, did you come across any aglaonemas while you're on your travels through South America? Because I should have found out where they're native to, but I would have thought they might have popped up every now and then.
I'm not,
were they more Asian?
So I'm not.
Yeah,
I think I was about to say, I think they're more sort of Asian areas. So you're along your Philippines and places like that where you see some types of alocasias. So I know a few alocasias that I saw were plants that have been imported as well, yeah, that aren't native to Central America. It's in South America. It's just that they grow there. And here's another fact too. So everyone knows about Costa Rica for its coffee, but coffee is actually not Central South American and native. It's actually from Africa. It's just the climate there is really good to grow it in.
Of course, gee, that... Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? It's almost, I think, you know, similar things can be said for those medjool dates as well and things like that where, yeah, there are other places in the world where the climate is similar. So that makes sense. And, of course, you know, globalisation, botanic gardens like to have collections from around the world themselves, whether they be in South America or Australia or the US. It's what people want and that's what drives it. So, oh, fascinating. And I'm just trying to think as well, when you flew across there, did you... When you moved between countries in South America, were you actually crossing borders by road or were you flying between between the countries in South America?
So I usually fly between them. It was one country. I had to spend half a day in Bolivia,
right,
just from, so because Bolivia and Peru are quite close, especially down the southern part.
Yes.
So I just had to do a land crossing there and that was pretty sweet and easy to get through. But like everything else was just via plane. So... And like the plane system there is really, really good. I've had no issues with any of the airlines who I flew with. I had no issues getting around. Another big tip is for people to use Uber. Uber is brilliant because you can put your location in there, track your driver and know exactly where you're going.
And have a driver that's a local, which is another benefit yet again that could lead to a conversation that takes you down another interesting path. Fabulous, you know, another opportunity to gain the benefit of local knowledge. Wow. And I'm just trying to think, the exchange rate, the expense of it all, the exchange rate fairly good and you could get value for money as opposed to traveling somewhere like the US at the moment, which pretty much would bankrupt most people, I think, with the way the Australian dollar's going.
Absolutely, yeah.
So
what I found, Joe, was that that South America, so Peru, Colombia, quite cheap,
yep,
but Central American countries like Costa Rica was almost on par with Australia, and Panama was close too because of that US influence and the fact that Panama's a real bit of an odd country. So they use US currency for their banknotes. However, they have their own coins that they use.
Oh, wow. Okay.
There you go. Yeah, it's really, really weird.
Wow.
But it was... That's quite interesting. It took me a little while to sort of wrap my head in. But what you can actually do is you can use US dollars pretty much anywhere. It just sort of depends on the exchange rate. And a lot of those, a lot of the shops and places you go to will have their own sort of exchange rate made up. So it's always best to use local currency because it does help to keep their value and their dollar high.
Okay, that's good. Did you notice, just something that's popped into my mind as we speak, and we should wrap this interviewer up because we've been talking for a while now, but do they have, and you might have been going to the smaller towns, obviously, but did you notice in your travels, you know, what I want to call the garden centres that we have here, did you manage to sort of see any retail nurseries that might be equivalent to our favourite, you know, Oxley Nursery, something like that? Did you notice any of those over there? Did you go into any of them? And what did you notice?
I saw a couple of them. So most of the sort of things like that are like a flower market they've got set up.
Okay.
The flower ranges they make are absolutely spectacular.
I bet they are.
I remember in Peru, in Lima, I was just sort of wait a couple of days. So I did that. I just Googled nursery and like flower, like florists. And I sort of went around and had a look. And I remember I came past one place and I saw a Monstera Thai Constellation there. It was quite a big size one, like, in Australia, the retail value of that's probably worth about $300. And I saw one there. And I said to the stallholder, I said to him, how much does that cost? And he wrote down on a piece of paper and it worked out to be $24.
Okay. Oh, my God. Oh, I just slumped in my chair. Of course it is. Yeah, wow. But you did see. So often flowers would be mixed together with the plants is what you're saying, the ones that you did come across,
yep.
Which is that makes sense to me. And you could buy, and markets, no doubt. You popped into a couple of markets, and again, I presume mixed in with the you know, the fruits and the vegetables and the meats, there'd be a flower stall holder who's also selling plants. But
yeah,
a lot cheaper.
They're all local traders as well.
Yeah.
So, and like, because the tour company that I travelled with are really big on what they call responsible travelling. So that's not staying at the big chain hotels. That's not eating out at the big chain restaurants. It's actually going supporting local people and helping to keep their jobs and their income high. And like half the time, the food and the things that you buy from those local markets are actually a lot cheaper than what they would be if you were to buy from one of the big retail chains.
Yes, of course.
Down the road.
Yes, of course. And by all means, can you share with us, who did you travel with? That'd be, you know, I'm sure people are itching to know, and I don't mind sharing that because it sounds like they've got a great ethos. Which tour company did you travel with?
So I went with Intrepid. Intrepid were really, really good because that's the things that they market on. So they get you a local guide. So the local guide in Costa Rica was the one who said to me that about the differences in the seasons depending on which side of the mountains you're on. Yeah. And, like, it was another couple of just interesting things about Costa Rica, too, is we were talking about the plants at the moment, but I'll just briefly touch on some of the wildlife you see there. There's iguanas everywhere. I saw about a dozen sloths. Actually, one night when we came home from a restaurant, we were driving along, and there was a sloth that was on the road, and they only come down from the trees once every 7 to 10 days to go to the toilet. And so it was walking across the road. So we went and got a big stick and sort of let it grab hold and, like, helped it across, which
yes.
was, like... And the guide said, he said, the last time he'd seen one crossing the road was 18 years ago. So it's one of those like once-in-a-lifetime experience things.
Oh, fabulous. I can only imagine. That would have been, yes, we didn't even touch upon that. But what a fabulous trip. What are you planning next with plants at home and in closing? What are your plans for the plants at home and your own collection and for future travel?
So what I've realised with my collection, Joey, is I've actually got a few doubles of something. So I'm going to try and move some of those doubles on so that I can get a bit of space to put some bigger feature plants in to actually be able to grow a nice-sized melanocrysum, a nice-sized warrachianum, just some of those big plants that you see a lot on markets. They're like small colour, like they might be two-node rooted cuttings, but they're tiny and they're not actually able to get to these mature size,
yeah.
which is what you can see sometimes in the wild, and the potential's there. I just want to be able to grow them and be able to unlock that.
Oh, fabulous. And so that's the plan, is to really grow up your prize plants to the specimens that reflect what you've seen in your travels. And it sounds like Ecuador's on the radar in the future for your next trip.
Absolutely. Ecuador to see all the velvets.
Oh, that's wonderful. Andy, thank you so much for joining us today. I've been imagining the places and sights and sounds that you saw while you were over there. I think you mentioned to me that you were going to share some of your experiences with the Arid Society. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I'm going to do. partway through that at the moment, but I'm working up on a write-up to put in their newsletter, and there'll be a few photos that I'm going to put in there that I'm not going to share anywhere else. So it's one of those like member-only things that they get to lay their eyes on, and everyone else can just sit there and dream and think of what it might be.
Mm-hmm. Andy, how do people find you if they'd like to follow you on social media and just, you know, if they wanted to message you?
Yeah, so I've got I use my Plant Instagram account, Planty Andy. Yep. One thing that people should look at on there is I wanted to do an Instagram live when I was away in Panama, because there was an area I went there at the Sierra Gatel, which actually had varicosans that were everywhere, absolutely everywhere. I want to do a live for people to be able to see what I actually saw. However, because of the internet, I couldn't do that. So I did a 15-minute video, which is saved in the Instagram, the TV section or the movie section, whatever it is, okay, on my Instagram profile. So that's actually got a video on there walking through, sort of explaining what I'm seeing. And you'll sort of see, I'll be like looking along and then I'll stop and turn like 180 degrees around because I just walked past something that I looked a bit funny that I wanted to have a look at. So it just sort of puts into perspective in people, and like I show like some of the, because obviously a lot of these plants are epiphytes where we're growing them indoors. Yeah. They're actually, some of these plants can grow up the tops of canopies where we're used to seeing them in the ground. So, and like I noticed with the varicosans that I saw there too, a lot of them had a lot of moss on some of the pubescence, the hair on the petiole. So that's like it's something that no one in Australia has really sort of talked about yet on even the ASA pages. And also they seem to like areas with a lot of high airflow. So a lot of the leaves are always constantly moving around, as well as some of the markings are completely different to the Australian species that we have here too. Just a lot of little things like that that I sort of found out that I was like, oh, that's interesting. I can take that home and use that with my own personal collection, that information, to try and replicate my microclimate to be as similar as the climate where actually the plants are growing in the wild. Oh, so it was like a big lesson for me. I tried to be able to make it so people could see sort of what I saw and get a bit of an appreciation for how these plants grow, so that they can change, maybe tweak their setups a little bit to be able to get the maximum growth out of their plants and get them to look absolutely spectacular.
What a fantastic resource for people to access from their armchairs. You've done the hard work and we get to sort of get a snapshot into what you've seen. So I'll definitely be looking at that video. That's fantastic. I have murdered quite a few varicosums. I think I've fussed over them too much by the sounds of it, Andy. A bit of tough love and a bit of airflow, and that's all they need. So, wow. Thank you so much, Andy. That's been an absolute privilege speaking to you. You've painted a word picture that I'm sure everyone listening will greatly appreciate, and I certainly feel inspired to travel to that part of the world and experience some of the things that you've seen. So, Andy, thanks for joining me today.
No worries, Joe. Thanks very much. It's really nice for me able to give back to the podcast. It sort of put me down the windy road that I'm on at the moment, and I hope that it pulls a few more people across to really get into collecting plants as well. I'm really interested to see what's going to happen with it once it gets out.
Fabulous. See you, Andy.